Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Fiction Predictions.
This is Fiction Predictions from Mashable, a new podcast about the books, TV shows, and films of the past that predicted the world we live in today.
I'm Sam.
And I'm Nick.
I'm going to do a massive name drop right now. Maybe you want to throw in some kind of jingle.
Name drop.
We've got a very special guest for you.
Well, thank you for having me. My name is Stephen Merchant. I'm a writer and director.
What do you think of the name? We thought about it long and hard. We think it's a brilliant
Fiction
name.
Prediction?
Yeah.
I think it's good. Yeah, but I'm glad you clarified what it meant. I wouldn't have known just from the title. But now I do.
We sat down with Stephen Merchant, co-creator of the groundbreaking sitcoms The Office and Extras, to talk about his new film.
Called Fighting With My Family.
You're from that weird family, aren't you?
We're not weird.
Which follows the true life story of a young woman called Paige, who comes from a real life Norwich wrestling family. The family dream was to get their kids into WWE, which is the big leagues for wrestlers. But only Paige got signed and went off to Florida at the age of 18, 4,000 miles from home, to try and live this family dream for herself and for the people that she left behind.
The Rock!
We're huge fans.
Thank you so much.
But we also challenged Stephen to see if he can come up with a fiction prediction of his own.
Let me think. I'm immediately thinking about sort of things like movies like 2001, A Space Odyssey, you know, which has a very...
I'm sorry, Dave.
...sentient...
I'm afraid I can't do that.
...computer, essentially AI.
What are you talking about, Hal?
I know that you and Frank were planning to disconnect me.
...that is kind of interacting and, you know, both with the pilots of the spacecraft and is kind of in control of the spacecraft.
And I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
And then, of course, famously, spoiler alert, begins to take over the spacecraft and begins to bump off the pilots, the astronauts.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Help!
Which is one of those very real concerns people have now about the power of AI, right? That you know, what limitations do you put on this, on AI? We're only, you know, years away from computers being able to seemingly think, and they will have processing power way beyond any human, and they can presumably figure out every possible eventuality. And, you know, it's a very real concern, right, about, you know, what limits do we put on computers and their capabilities.
So just a quick word first on how this episode's going to be structured. It's a little different to episodes before because it's essentially two fiction predictions rather than just one. They're both going to revolve around Stephen Merchant's work and how his comedy analyzes and foreshadows aspects of society. To start with, Nick's going to be employing his impressively philosophical, kind of analytical approach to The Office. And then after, we're going to bring back the interview with Stephen Merchant towards the end of the episode, and I'm going to talk about Extras.
Here we go. So, Sam, I know you're a considerable fan of the original Office, starring Ricky Gervais, and I'm also quite disappointed because I know that you haven't yet watched the US reboot.
I'm disappointed in myself. It's on my long... I've got a really long list of things to watch, but I love the original so much, and I've heard the US version is quite different, but it's also brilliant.
Either way, just seeing the UK one, has it ever struck you how utterly meaningless, pointless, and absolutely useless all the actual jobs...
I'm a sales rep.
which means that my job is
to speak to clients.
Are in that show.
Quantity and type of paper, whether we...
Yes.
Supply it to them, whether they can...
pay for it.
I'm boring myself just talking about this.
Anyway, when Stephen was talking about AI and, you know, 2001 A Space Odyssey...
I keep going to very dark places in the podcast. I'm sorry about that.
I should have just said, I hope
there's hoverboards like in Back to the Future 2.
Something potentially profound struck me about the universal appeal that The Office has had on the world we live in today.
In the past 10 years, I have had to prophesy evil.
And it's an appeal that goes back nearly 100 years to a very influential, if quite mercurial, British economist.
Change has been forced on us under circumstances... extraordinarily fortunate and favorable.
John Maynard Keynes.
I'm afraid to say I don't know him, but I do love the fact you described it as potentially profound. I'm very excited.
We have nothing to fear.
Well, listen to this.
Honestly, nothing.
So Keynes was a huge public figure. He's the founding father of Keynesian economics, which basically argues that the free market cannot be left unregulated and that the government should interfere and invest to help reduce unemployment levels at times of economic difficulty. His ideas were criticized over the years, but they resurfaced recently and became really popular when Barack Obama introduced stimulus packages to help create jobs.
It is a wonderful thing for our businessmen and our manufacturers and our unemployed
and
to taste hope again.
I know we talk about automating jobs a lot today, but the trend really began in those early days where machines were introduced on the factory floors. In 1928, Keynes predicted that at the start of the 21st century, the technological efficiency in Europe and in the US would be so great that people would no longer actually need to work and would start suffering from boredom and too much free time.
I'm boring myself.
He basically thought that the machines would just do all our work and we will have enough money and food and we wouldn't have to actually do any physical work or labor.
That hasn't quite panned out, has it?
No, that's why The Office is quite important, because something quite to the opposite really came true. To avoid this absolute boredom of having nothing to do, Keynes, again in 1928, anticipated that humans would sort of get accustomed to a 3 hour a day, just to feel useful kind of job.
I don't think anyone works a 3 hour work day.
No. And what's worse is there's a lot of conversation that's starting to come out that shows that our generation is suffering from things like burnout, and there's a lot of existential questions that we tend to ask ourselves about our value and our purpose and how our work is supposed to fulfill ourselves as individuals that are here to carry out some sort of meaningful purpose on this earth.
So what you're saying is Keynes, he didn't make a good prediction.
No.
Okay.
He failed miserably.
Oh. Sorry, John. I mean, it sounds like a sound theory at the time.
Yeah.
It's summed up pretty well in that sort of long read article that BuzzFeed, I believe, published about millennial burnout. It's almost about a whole generation has been kind of obsessed with or focused on the type of self-betterment that they think is acceptable in society and sort of social media and everything like that, that they're kind of almost paralyzed into really like having something I identified with a little bit, actually. Yeah. Really not wanting to do something we would view as like a trivial life admin job, like, you know, filling out a form or something.
So more or less the opposite of what Keynes predicted actually has come true.
Okay. So you're saying that Keynes made this prediction. He was completely wrong, but The Office is actually a more accurate... It's kind of accidentally predicted the way working lives in 2019 are.
Yes.
To what extent do you believe that you have the skills and knowledge to perform your job effectively? And then you just tick one of the boxes. Not at all. To some extent, very much so, don't know. What would you tick?
Don't know.
So here we go.
Okay.
This goes back a little bit.
Okay, go on.
In a 2013 essay that went pretty viral, this American anthropologist called David Graeber diagnosed this phenomenon as, quote, bullshit jobs that nobody wants to talk about. Here's another direct quote. Bullshit jobs are a form of paid employment that is so completely pointless, unnecessary, or pernicious that even the employee cannot justify its existence, even though, as part of the conditions of employment, the employee feels obliged to pretend that this is not the case. So here's where Stephen Merchant and Ricky Gervais' work comes in.
I'm boring myself.
with The Office, it seems like they tapped into a phenomenon that became so popular because it was still hiding in plain sight. In a way, The Office predicted the utter meaninglessness that has engulfed work life in the recent decades. YouGov, a data analytics firm here in the UK, polled British people in 2015 asking whether they thought that their jobs made a meaningful contribution to the world. 37% said no. 13% were unsure.
37% said no. That's sad, isn't it?
But it's not just in the UK. So in the Netherlands, 40% of respondents believed that their jobs had no reason to exist.
Wow. So you're if I'm getting this right, you're saying The Office predicted this kind of trend of us talking about meaningless work and like burnout at work and people not having any sort of sense of value from what they do.
I think the Office in more than one ways predicted this notion of bullshit jobs that this anthropologist went out and then empirically showed to be true. I think The Office is a great example that shows that the contemporary society that we live in today is one that has sort of forgotten what it's for.
Mm.
Like, we don't really have a purpose. You know, you have the baby boomers, you have, you know, the people during the world wars where everybody was sort of like eager and they thought they had a part to play in the larger scheme of things. And you had like the fall of the Berlin Wall, the end of the Cold War. You know, you had the rise of the internet, the early years of positivity of the internet. And now, especially in the last sort of 20 years-ish, you're just seeing the fallout of different sort of processes. You're seeing the fallout of, you know, globalization. We had the financial crisis. It's people are getting laid off left and right. You know, people are worried about automation and sort of more and more people that are going into the workforce sort of don't really know like what they're supposed to do and they don't really see the purpose of their contribution.
That was an impressive speech. I can tell, you know, I can tell when I listen to you sometimes that you're a doctor.
Yeah, and actually this actually leads in well to my final point, which
go on.
So obviously I just completed my doctorate in anthropology, and this guy who came up with the concept of bullshit jobs, he's an anthropologist too. Funny enough, Stephen was also talking about how he and Ricky came up with the idea for The Office, and my sort of academic brain immediately lit up because neither of them sort of launched their career in entertainment. And they were both saying how this idea for the character of David Brent was a conglomeration of all these people that they had to work with in the past. And now we know, thanks to, you know, David Graeber's idea of bullshit jobs, that that's exactly what they were experiencing. And it's funny that they sort of categorized it and used it for comedic value because it was something that I guess wasn't so centralized as it is now. Like, it wasn't that obvious, right?
It was just, I imagine, like, yeah, it was perhaps something that people were aware of to some level, but maybe it's being spoken about more now.
Curiously, it has a very anthropological sort of epicenter as well. So Stephen and Ricky were working in radio beforehand, and then Stephen moved to the BBC. And there he was asked to do a task, and he wanted to do sort of a TV scenario of the task. And so he asked Ricky to come in. They were sort of recreating a more or less like an office environment. And that's where they came up with the character of David Brent.
A lot of the kind of questions that you have when you've got a fictional character, which are making that stuff up, let's take, for instance, David Brent in The Office, you know, a lot of time was spent, you know, deciding where he's from and what did he do and what's his life. You know, even stuff that didn't make it into the finished script, but you want to have answers to those questions just so you understand the character.
And it was something that they kept seeing, sort of the pointlessness of these sort of pencil pushing, you know, bureaucratic jobs with meaningless titles that everybody sort of was regurgitating, and it didn't matter who the individual doing the job was, anybody could do them. And that's where the inspiration for The Office came.
I don't give shitty jobs. If a good man comes to me and says, "Thank you, David, for the opportunity and continued support in the work-related arena, but I've done that, I want to better myself, I want to move on," then I can make that dream come true too, aka for you. The point is, you talk the talk, you do not walk the walk, vis-a-vis, you have not yet passed your forklift driver's test.
I guess, like, you know, and this will probably crop up in other episodes, but I guess one aspect of good comedy is almost being able to, like, identify pulses in society that, you know, and kind of reflect. It's like holding up a mirror, isn't it, back at society, and people can laugh because they see themselves or people they know in the show. And I guess I feel like this is something Stephen Merchant and Ricky Gervais have been able to tap into quite impressively in a lot of their work. So obviously we've spoken a lot about The Office there, and I think now we can transition maybe into part two of the episode. So that was your prediction. We'll come back to it at the end, because I think it's a good prediction, and it'll be interesting to see how you think my prediction, which is to do with extras, how it measures up. The thing that I've always been fascinated about, sort of switching over to extras now, and one thing that I was really keen to ask Stephen about when we spoke to him, is his track record of kind of casting celebrities as themselves. Yeah, so here's Stephen talking about it in like a short 2005 behind-the-scenes documentary about extras.
And the idea of using the stars was never like to try and be kind of really sort of in-jokey and let's pat ourselves on the back for having some showbiz mates. It was just to try and add as much realism to the world as possible. And because you already had a perception of who they were, then you could play with the image they already had, and it was like a shortcut to comedy. You could get straight in and they were sort of...
The reason I thought of this is when I watched Fighting With My Family...
good film.
Yeah, it is really good, actually. I definitely recommend watching it. It's got a very kind of poignant mix of comedy and drama. So when I watched it, I was like, oh, it's interesting that, you know, Stephen Merchant's film. The Rock's in it playing himself.
Well, he was involved in Page's real life story, and so the scenes that we dramatise involving him are based on stories that Page and he told me about what had happened for real. And so, again, you're using the true incidents as your jumping off point. And then Dwayne, DJ, you know, he called me up and he was like, well, I felt like we should do this or this, and he had notes and thoughts about it, you know, because he was there. And so it becomes a sort of collaboration in that way. And, you know, Dwayne is Dwayne, but he's also at times playing The Rock, you know, which is more of his wrestling persona. That is him, you know, at his own magnificence. So I just, in a sense, I mean, I didn't quite, but I may as well have just written Dwayne does The Rock here in brackets and then he just goes off and does his own thing, you know, because you can't write that stuff.
And obviously extras, that was basically one of the running themes. Every episode had a different celebrity, you know, often very well-known people, and they played a kind of certain twisted version of themselves.
You know, I began this project... And the idea of sort of celebrities and famous people being in it and all the rest of it was not something that came into my head. Initially, I was just interested in this real family with this real...
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Story. I didn't know who these people were. I didn't follow wrestling. I didn't know anything about wrestling. I was attracted to the story because I just found the emotional content of it so appealing and engaging. This brother and sister relationship, this family relationship, this young woman who's got to leave home, travel away. So I just kept thinking about it as a group of people who, you know, just real people. And so it was only later that, of course, I sort of began to realize, well, yes, but then she entered into the world of WWE, which is full of famous wrestlers, one of whom is The Rock. And so in a weird way, The Rock was still just a character in this story. You know, I wasn't thinking of him as a famous person. I was just thinking of him as a real person in this narrative. Unlike, say, extras, where we were more playing and sort of caricaturing those actors and allowing them to sort of play twisted versions of themselves. And there was more playfulness and there was more satire intended there. Whereas here, Dwayne was just Dwayne, who was part of this real life story. And so it's a sort of strange coincidence that I keep on having real people playing themselves in projects I've done, but I don't. It's not like that's the only thing I'll do in my work. It just keeps happening in that way, bizarrely.
How does this make a good fiction prediction?
My thinking is, in a nutshell, is that in extras, and particularly the way you have famous people playing exaggerated versions of themselves, I think that in some way predicted the way people behave on social media today.
If you look back at the kind of in the 30s, 40s, 50s, Hollywood stars were very inaccessible. You saw them in movies.
I'd rather wait in there.
And you saw them in...
I hate crowds.
In magazines, and that was it.
Don't you?
There very rarely were there. I mean, there wasn't really any TV talk shows until the sort of 50s and 60s. And so, you know, someone like...
Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to present you to...
Errol Flynn or one of those kind of movie stars from the 50s. They were very remote. Gary Cooper. And so you'd occasionally get these pictorials and it would be them in their Hollywood mansion and it would be them diving in the pool and them having a cocktail. But it was all very staged and very, very manufactured in their true lives. And their decadent behavior or their sexuality, all that stuff was kept from the public, right? You know, and then what happened is over time, you know, celebrities became more and more accessible. And, you know, in the 80s, they were sort of being hounded by the paparazzi. And, you know, you had Tom Cruise coming out of every building he left. There was camera crews outside of it.
I think everyone has my number. And that's the problem.
And it feels in a way now we've almost come full circle where the audience demands access to their favorite stars. And so they have to be sort of on social media or seen to be connecting and being honest and being themselves and sort of and breaking down the walls between them and us. But actually, they're curating their version of themselves just like those old 50s stars did. They're not really presenting themselves. Who wants to do that? Who wants to just let you see every nook and cranny, every wart of someone, right? So now on social media, it's, in a way, it feels like it's those old 1950s magazine cover spreads where, you know, it's Errol Flynn in his Hollywood mansion. And it's sort of now, it's kind of celebrities in their Hollywood mansion. And then it's non-celebrities trying to look like they also live the life of celebrities, right? So we sort of, you know, I was reading a story the other day about someone in Russia you can pay to have an hour sitting in a private jet with your friends. So you can just take photos of you drinking champagne in a private jet. Now, presumably, the people that you're posting that to, your 14 followers, know you don't have the money to fly around in a private jet. So I don't know who you're fooling. It reminds me of when I was at school, this kid came into school. I did not go to a fancy school and I did not have fancy, wealthy friends. This kid came to school and he had what appeared to be a Rolex. He's like, yeah, got a Rolex, no big deal. And we're like, wow. And then it very quickly became clear it was a knockoff fake Rolex because he couldn't afford a Rolex. Just like, well, you've got a fake Rolex and we all know it's a fake Rolex. Yeah. So again, who are you fooling? And so, and so it's a sort of strange, it feels like a slightly strange time where, you know, celebrities and non-celebrities are presenting this idealized version of themselves on social media, right? I don't quite know where that will lead us, but...
Well, what's your idealized version? Like, what part do you create when you go on Twitter or
Instagram? Well, it's slightly different for me because I
come... ideal in real life. So
well, no, I was going to say, because I'm from the comedy world, I guess you use it in a slightly different way. I actually like showing my own hopelessness in so many different ways, in ways that can be funny. And you know, like I did a post recently about how hard it is for me to write in hotel rooms because I can never get a desk that's high enough. Like, your desk here is too low for me. And so I have to construct kind of writing desks when I'm working from a hotel room with sort of ironing boards or drawers and, you know, cushions, and I have to build these things. And that's true. So it's a sort of playful little insight into my life. But of course, again, it's still it's just a segmented version of part of my life. It's not like I'm on there, you know, and I'm giving you every moment of my day and every thought I'm having, you know. So I think you still sort of curate it, you're still policing it, even if you're being funny, even if you're, I don't know. I'm interested to know, maybe you feel like that's a mischaracterization. Maybe you feel like people are much more honest and truthful about in their social media. Maybe they are. I don't know. Do you feel that's true?
No.
Do you feel like you're presenting a kind of version of yourself in a way?
Yeah, to my 14 followers. Yeah, sure. Right. But I think everybody has to, right?
But otherwise, you're just living your life like an open wound. I mean, it's, you know, everyone's got their
desperate times,
demons and their issues, and no one wants to present. No one wants everyone to know their true self, do they?
No.
No.
Wow, this got pretty existential.
I just wanted to quickly come back to one thing, and like talking about celebrities and that idea of curation. Like now that everyone's got a phone, they're asking you for selfies all the time, someone might be videoing any interaction you have on the streets. Do you think, rather than even just say for paparazzi and on social media, is there a pressure now to be, do you think, for celebrities to be constantly wearing a mask wherever they go almost?
I think so, to some degree. I mean, I'm going to do a massive name drop right now. I don't know, maybe you want to throw in some kind of jingle?
Name drop.
Because this is pretty heavy-handed name drop. But I was talking to Tom Cruise once.
Nice.
And and I was asking him about how his experience of being a celebrity had changed over the years. And he pointed to a moment. He said he used to have, there were kind of paparazzi that would wait outside hotel rooms and hotels and stuff for him and studios, and he would come out, and there was a sort of certain acknowledgement that, you know, you'd leave the building and they would take pictures and then, you know, off you'd go with your day. And then he says he remembers coming out once and a woman came up to him with a phone and took a picture of him with her phone, and he said, what's that? And she went, I've got a camera on my phone. And it was the first time he'd seen it. And he said he remembered thinking, wow, everything's going to change. You know, he could sense it even at that moment, you know. And so I guess that was probably a huge turning point where you were sort of, for someone like him, you're suddenly much more mindful of the fact that the traditional days of the paparazzi with cameras and the sort of gentleman's agreement, you know, I'll take some pictures of you coming out of the hotel, getting in your car, then I leave you alone, had kind of suddenly changed. And now, obviously, everyone has a camera and everyone's a paparazzi to some degree. And anyone who's in the public eye is conscious that they never quite know when they're being filmed. You know, I've got friends, you know, who've been filmed or photographed when they're asleep on a plane, or, you know, you often sense it on if I'm on the tube, and someone will kind of, their camera will rise up and they'll have forgotten to take the little click noise off. And it's pretty obvious what you're up to.
Yeah.
You know, and so, of course, you have to be very aware of that. You can't be yourself because you want to be able to control what people know of you.
How do you react in those situations? Like, are you tempted to go over and say, sorry, do you mind actually not taking a picture? Or do
just swoop in and grab the phone from above?
No, but it's very intrusive, isn't it?
I mean, yeah,
it's
a
very,
you know, it is, yeah.
It's a very, you know, yes, you've made an exchange in some ways that you get the privileges of being, you know, in the public eye and make movies and do all these amazing things, and that's great. And you understand there's a certain exchange that happens. But nevertheless, you know, you're going about your day. It's a little bit creepy if someone takes a picture. The other thing you notice is that if you're walking down the street and someone knows who you are and they are with a friend and they walk past you, they will often wait till they've walked past you to say, oh, you know who that was. But they never walk far enough. You can always hear them saying it. And it's a warning to everyone. You have to walk further than you think if you're going to talk about someone behind their back, all right? And that's good advice for office life, your friends. Yes. It doesn't matter if they're a famous person or not. Just walk further than you think before you start gossiping about someone, right, all right? Little word to the wise.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, okay. So we've got decision time here. We've got two predictions, really, in this episode. Obviously themed around Stephen Merchant. Yours about The Office predicting this rising awareness of bullshit job culture. Mine about extras predicting this specific way people act on social media. So, this is tricky, isn't it? What do we think is the better prediction?
I mean, just think about it. The Office became like an international hit. It was translated and adapted in however many countries. And the universal message of people unfortunately having to do completely meaningless jobs is something that not only goes against all the logic of the technological sort of innovations that we've made since the Industrial Revolution, but it also goes against the logic of all the cool things that are going on today.
Hang on a second. So are you saying that because The Office was more popular, that means your prediction is better?
I think it's just such a universal prediction about the state of humanity that affects, I think, a majority of people who end up working. I don't think I've ever met someone that has started a job after university or, you know, whenever, and they've come and said, do you know what? I think I'm completely fulfilled by this job.
Do you like your job, Nick? Do you feel fulfilled doing this podcast with me?
Yes.
Okay.
But you know what I mean.
No, I completely know what you mean.
I think we're quite privileged as journalists because we get to do creative things, and sometimes we get to do things that have a wider sort of societal impact, and maybe some people can read some of our stuff, and sometimes we can amplify voices that, you know, don't have a platform of their own.
Yeah, I guess there's almost two things, isn't there? So there's your own personal sense of self-worth, and then there's also this kind of, the other thing The Office was tapping into is this kind of like layers of bureaucracy. And yeah, I think, to be honest, I think it's a good prediction. I think The Office, I'm sure, certainly in my kind of, yeah, like fairly narrow knowledge of comedy, like it feels like The Office has done it in a way that's been, yeah, like you said, the most globally sort of well received. So I think it's a good prediction. I think my extras prediction, if I'm going to be totally honest, brutally honest, I would say yours is probably a little bit better. Only because I think there is something, definitely something in this idea of self-curation. And I think that was definitely a topic explored in Extras, not so much self-curation, but kind of obviously Extras is, it's all about self-parody and kind of, you know, caricaturing yourself. And I think that does foreshadow an aspect of social media, but I think it's probably getting into the nitty gritty a little bit.
I was really hoping that you would say that, but I actually genuinely think that you're on to something with your fiction prediction. And it's actually quite interesting because I was literally listening to an episode of another podcast called Invisibilia, and the episode is called Post-Shoot. And they were sort of talking about this, and the central theme of the episode was the doppelganger almost relationship that we have with our online selves, where they are curated versions of ourselves but not entirely who we are in real life.
Okay.
So the episode is about violence in this town in Delaware, and it basically revolves around the murder of a kid who was basically trash talking another kid on Instagram, and it led to his murder.
Right, okay, so I guess that's a kind of different facet of this idea of the way we behave online and the part of ourselves we choose to show, I guess. Because obviously, yeah, we were talking about the comedy, but I suppose there's also the darker side of...
It just shows that people are prone to taking what they see online as the full story.
Right, yeah.
But a long story short, you know, I think that this idea of the separation between the real self and the portions of that self that appear online, that sort of dichotomy, as you said before, is something that definitely didn't exist in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
And that sense of the caricaturization of, you know, the most... I don't know, the most extreme parts of the personality that we see with, you know, Ben Stiller, for example, in Extras.
Yeah, it's basically playing on society's most extreme ideas of someone, the most extreme parts of their public persona, if you like.
This sense of, like, you could be someone else on social media. Like, you can present yourself as, you know, anyone you want to be. You can pretend like you're rich, you can pretend like you're powerful, you can pretend like you're well liked. Most people are not really going to question it, are they? They're going to take it for the face value, assuming that that's first of all true and that's all that you are. Mm. Right?
Yeah, no, well, completely, yeah. And I guess catfishing, like that phenomenon, is evidence of that. Okay, well, yeah, two fiction predictions for the price of one there this week. Thanks for tuning in.
As always, please leave us a comment or a rating on whichever podcast platform you're using to listen to us. Next week, Sam will be presenting a pretty special fiction prediction. We're not going to say a lot
But it's related to the Titanic, and I think it's potentially one of the most prescient examples I think I've seen of fiction predicting the future. So yeah, please do tune in.
Fiction predictions.
Right, guys, and just a heads up, if you are interested to watch the full interview with Stephen, it's uploaded on Mashable's YouTube account and on Mashable.com. Just search for, you know, Stephen Merchant Fiction Predictions, and you should be able to find it. I recommend you actually do spend some time. It's about 15 minutes long, and it's definitely worth it because Stephen is obviously very, very funny, and I'm pretty gutted that I had to cut some of the things from the actual podcast, so this is your chance to actually see and hear the full unedited conversation that we had him. And once again, I just wanted to thank him. It means a lot that he came on the show, and I hope you all liked the episode. Thanks, bye.
Fiction Predictions is a Mashable podcast created by Sam Hasem and Nikolai Nikolov. The theme song was composed by Kasberg. The artwork was designed by Bob Algreen. And this episode was edited by Nick.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode, and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at UH1.com.